Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 176 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, the first test flight of the Soviet N-1. If you haven't done so already, I recommend that you listen to episodes 174 and 175, the early history of the N-1, before you listen to this episode. Before we get to the flight, I wanted to review the specs of the N-1 and compare it to the Saturn V. The fully equipped N-1 stood 105 meters, or 344 feet tall, with its L3 payload. The N-1-L3 combination had five stages. The first three on the N-1 were for insertion into low Earth parking orbit, and the other two were associated with the L3 complex and were used for translunar injection and lunar orbit insertion. Fully loaded and fueled, the N-1-L3 weighed 2,750 metric tons, or 6,062,000 pounds. The lower three stages were shaped to produce a single frustum, 17 meters or 56 feet wide at the base. The L3 section was mostly cylindrical and was carried inside a shroud 3.5 meters or 11 feet wide. The conical shaping of the lower stages was due to the arrangement of the tanks within them. A smaller spherical kerosene tank on top of the larger liquid oxygen tank below. The first stage, called Block A, was powered by 30 NK-15 engines arranged in two rings. The main ring of 24 at the outer edge of the booster, and the core propulsion system consisting of the inner six engines at about half that diameter. The engines were the first ever staged combustion cycle engines. The control system was primarily based on differential throttling of the engines of the outer ring for pitch and yaw. The inner ring system was not used for control. The Block A also included four grid fins, which were later used on Soviet air-to-air missile designs. In total, the Block A produced 45,400 kilonewtons, or 10,200,000 pound force of thrust. This exceeded the 33,700 kilonewton, or 7.6 million pound force thrust of the Saturn V. But the Saturn V used higher specific impulse liquid hydrogen fuel in the second and third stages, which eliminated one of the stages needed to get to translunar injection, thus saving weight. The second stage, called Block B, was powered by 8 NK-15V engines arranged in a single ring. The only major difference between the NK-15 and the NK-15V was the engine bell and various tunings for air start and high altitude performance. The upper stage, called Block V, mounted four smaller NK-21 engines in a square pattern. The control system was called CORD, K-O-R-D, and it stood for Control of Rocket Engines. The CORD system controlled the differential thrusting of the outer ring of 24 engines on the first stage for pitch and yaw attitude control by throttling them appropriately, and it also shut down malfunctioning engines situated opposite to each other. This was to negate the pitch or yaw movement diametrically opposing engines in the outer ring would generate, thus maintaining a symmetrical thrust. The N-1 could continue to fly even if it lost some engines. For example, the Block A first stage could perform nominally with two pairs of opposing engines shut down. In other words, with 26 of the 30 engines working. Block B, the second stage, could continue with one pair of opposing engines shut down, which means 6 of the 8 engines working. And the third stage, Block V, could continue with one engine shut down, or 3 of the 4 engines functioning. Now, a little comparison with the Saturn V. At 105 meters, the N1L3 was slightly shorter and more slender than the Apollo Saturn V. But the N1 was wider at the base, 17 meters versus 10 meters for the Saturn V. The N1 produced more thrust in each of its three stages than the Saturn V. It also produced more total impulse in its first four stages than the Saturn V did in its three. The N1 was intended to place 95 metric tons of payload into low Earth orbit, whereas the Saturn V placed roughly 45 tons of the Apollo spacecraft plus 74 tons of fuel used for translunar injection. So the Saturn V put roughly 119 metric tons into low Earth orbit. Okay, another difference. With the N1L3, the translunar injection of the 23.5 metric ton payload was provided by the fourth stage. But with the Saturn V, translunar injection was accomplished with the third stage. Another difference was the type of fuel used. The N1L3 used only kerosene-based rocket fuel in all three of its stages, while the Saturn V used liquid hydrogen to fuel its second and third stages, which yielded an overall performance advantage due to the higher specific impulse. The N1 also wasted available propellant volume by using spherical propellant tanks under its conical-shaped external skin, while the Saturn V used most of its available cylindrical skin volume to house capsule-shaped hydrogen and oxygen tanks, with the old common bulkhead between the tanks in the second and third stages. Saturn V also had a superior reliability record. It never lost a payload in 2 development flights and 11 operational launches. While 4 N1 development launches all resulted in failure, with 2 payload losses. Now I want to move on to the flight plan for the first launch. The N1 rocket was to carry a simplified prototype of the L3 lunar complex. It was called 7K-L1-S, which was about 30% lighter than the rocket's standard payload for manned lunar landing. The payload section was fashioned out of a 7K-L1 spacecraft designed to fly around the moon. To give the spacecraft additional maneuverability during a more complex mission, it was upgraded with a custom-built attitude control unit mounted on the top of the vehicle. The flight plan called for inserting this improvised spacecraft into lunar orbit rather than simply swinging it behind the moon. Inside its descent capsule, the spacecraft was reportedly carrying powerful cameras intended for photographing lunar surfaces and delivering exposed film back to Earth. According to most sources, the unmanned crew capsule was equipped with an operational emergency escape rocket. Since the main digital computer for the N1L3 complex wasn't ready, the flight would be controlled with a makeshift analog system. Moreover, the NK-15V engines on the second stage of the rocket were lacking their nozzle extensions. Both of these fallback solutions degraded the capabilities of the rocket. However, with a reduced payload mass, all critical phases of the flight could be tested. The powered flight of the rocket was to last for 597 seconds, placing the Block G and Block D stages along with their spacecraft payload into parking orbit around the Earth. Block G would then fire its engine, sending the payload on a 3.5-day trip toward the moon, and separate. Block D would then make a necessary course correction and then fire again to ease the spacecraft into lunar orbit, where the stack was to spend another 2.5 or 3.5 days. Block D then would fire for the third time, sending the spacecraft back toward Earth. In case of a complete success of the first and following launches, the actual lunar landing of Soviet cosmonauts was still likely 2 years away due to the need to certify all the other components of the L3 complex, such as the LOK spacecraft and the LK lunar lander. And, of course, there was still testing required for all phases of the flight. Moving along, on February 9, 1969, a meeting of the State Commission in Tyratam was held with the goal of confirming the official launch date for the first N1 rocket and clearing it for rollout to the launch pad on the same day. The majority of civilian members of the commission pressed for a launch as soon as possible. After all, with the lack of test facilities for a fully assembled rocket, only an actual launch could provide real-time data and reveal problems. That's how it had always been done in the Soviet Union from the dawn of the space era. Except that now the rocket was much more expensive and required so much more time to build. Of course, mid-level telemetry specialists and military test officers in Tyratam were well aware of numerous unsolved issues with the vehicle. Many problems were apparently revealed even during the final integration test, which had just recently been completed in the assembly building. Not coincidentally, the test officers who conducted these tests were excluded from the group of officials whose signature were required on the final certification documents. However, during the meeting on February 9th, General Kurushin, the military chief at Tyratam Test Range, made a shocking call not to launch, citing numerous problems in the launch equipment and the rocket itself. Surprised by the opposition to the launch at such a high level, the Minister of General Machine Building, Sergei Afanasyev, called for a pause in the meeting. During the break, Afanasyev, Vasily Mishin, and the Central Committee's representative, Stroganov, along with other industry officials, pressed General Kurushin and his military superiors to reconsider. Marshal Krylov, the highest military officer at the meeting, finally surrendered on the condition that all the issues cited by General Kurushin would be resolved before launch. In the end, the rocket was cleared to make its monumental trip to the launch pad. The fueling of the payload section with its toxic and corrosive propellants was scheduled to start on February 13th, marking the so-called irreversible operations, after which it would be very difficult to cancel the flight. The launch was set for February 18th. In addition, three more N1 rockets were scheduled to fly in April, June, and November of 1969, even though the L3 lunar complex was not expected to be ready for a manned mission until the following year. All right, let's talk a little bit about the politics surrounding the launch. In preparation for the first N1 launch, the Central Research Institute of Machine Building was assigned the politically sensitive task of putting an actual number on the expected reliability of the N1L3. The Institute made these estimates based on a very detailed failure record of 30 Soviet missiles and space launch vehicles. This allowed the Institute to predict that the probability for the first N1 mission to complete all its tasks barely exceeded 1%. Even with the most optimistic assumptions about the performance of all its stages, the N1 only had 16 out of 100 chances to fulfill its mission. The head of the Central Research Institute of Machine Building was Yuri Mazorin, and he knew it would be political suicide to officially present such grim statistics. Still trying to keep a semblance of scientific approach, he ordered a recalculation of the data minus any considerations of failure caused by lack of quality control and by operational errors. Only failures rooted in previously unknown phenomena would now be factored in. After all the massaging of the data, the Institute arrived at a 67% probability of the first N1 completing its task, with a margin of error spanning from 38 to 90%. Mazorin, now believing that he finally had politically acceptable results, announced his 67% chance of success at the State Commission meeting on the eve of the first launch. However, his optimistic prognosis was met with a graveyard silence. Nikolai Polyugin, the head of Flight Control Systems Development, was the first to utter a word. While admitting that nobody had the right to certify the vehicle for launch with such a high probability of failure, he proposed to dismiss the whole exercise of relying on historical record. Polyugin argued that only personal assurances from all top managers about flawless operation of their systems could serve as a legitimate criterion in a launch decision. The majority agreed, not the least of whom was Mazorin, because his organization would no longer be held responsible for a possible disaster. With the preliminaries finished, we will move on to the launch. The first 28-day long N1 countdown began in January of 1969 with the rollout of the N1 to the pad. Vasily Mishin personally led 2,300 technicians in around-the-clock shifts to prepare the vehicle for its first flight. 50 tank cars of propellant were required to fuel the booster. Not surprisingly, as soon as the rocket was powered up on the launch pad, its telemetry revealed numerous problems. For several weeks, military officers and their civilian colleagues struggled to prepare the vehicle and fix problems, often working dozens of meters above the ground on the open surface tower in a bitter cold, minus 30 degrees Celsius, and winds reaching 12 meters per second. Finally, on the morning of February 21st, all the population of the N1 assembly area and a residential area situated just south of the launch pad was ordered to evacuate. The giant structure then rolled away, leaving the dark gray rocket with a white payload fairing towering under the sunny skies. The weather was extremely cold, with temperatures falling to minus 44 degrees Celsius and stormy winds. In the fortified firing control room, the commander of the 6th Directorate took the firing command position at the main periscope. The liftoff button was pressed at 12:17 and 55 seconds Moscow time. The 30 engines of the first stage needed 12 seconds to develop the thrust necessary to lift the giant rocket off the ground. At 12:18 and 7 seconds, the first N1 vehicle lifted off. As it was rising above the launch pad, telemetry officers reported shutdown of two engines. However, the rocket, emitting a long trail of fire and black smoke, continued flying seemingly stable. The deafening roar reached onlookers miles away and then started subsiding as the rocket was receding from view. After about a minute, the bright glow of its engines suddenly faltered. The loudspeaker announcements of the flight milestones also stopped. For a few seconds, the rocket continued climbing slowly, and then, to the horror of observers, started descending down, seemingly in one piece. A faraway flash of light confirmed its impact. In less than 2 minutes, several years of effort by engineers and workers had been turned into heaps of twisted and burned metal. In the immediate aftermath of the accident, most witnesses could only guess what had made the rocket suddenly stop firing all its engines. The monitoring data showed that the vehicle reached an altitude of 14 kilometers and crashed 183 seconds after liftoff. At least one source claimed that the emergency escape system at the top of the rocket had fired successfully, pulling away the unmanned spacecraft and enabling its descent module to safely land under a parachute. Very preliminary information showed that in the first seconds of the flight, engine number 12 and number 24 had shut down. The remaining 28 engines of the first stage ceased operation at T plus 68.7 seconds. While officials were still in the firing bunker, OKB-1 chief designer Mission was quick to lay blame on the developer of the power supply system. Mission claimed that turbo generators producing electricity on board had failed. After all, what else could stop all engines of the first stage at once? Trying not to jump to conclusions, Sergei Afanasyev appointed Mission to lead the investigative commission. A helicopter and ground teams were sent to recover the debris scattered along the flight. The main crash site of the rocket was found in the snow-covered steep 52 kilometers northeast from the launch pad. Smaller pieces of the rocket apparently fell elsewhere. Meanwhile, engineers started deciphering the telemetry data. The telemetry confirmed that the power supply system kept operating all the way until impact. Search teams also recovered the power supply system, which was then rushed to the manufacturer, where it was successfully restarted, thus proving Mission wrong. It was not the power supply that caused the problem. Early data also pointed at a fire in the tail section of the first stage. But the investigation quickly focused on the behavior of the cord rocket control system, which had the capability to shut down individual engines. Chief Designer Mission ordered the creation of a small sub-commission on the cord system, appointing Chertok as its head. After 3 days, telemetry specialists confirmed that all the engines of the first stage had been deactivated by the cord system. By the beginning of March 1969, after a repeated thorough analysis of telemetry tapes, followed by many discussions and calculations, a true picture of the failure started emerging. This is what happened. At 0.34 seconds after liftoff, as the engines reached full thrust, the cord system issued a faulty command to shut down engine number 12. This command was triggered by electric interference originating in the cord's wiring located near engine number 12, when pyrotechnics blew up valves opening the propellant supply. The oversensitive cord system interpreted the resulting power surge in its circuitry as a sign that the turbopump in engine number 12 was spinning faster than it was supposed to and was about to explode. According to its algorithm, the cord also turned off engine number 24 on the opposite side of the rocket in order to maintain symmetry of the thrust. However, other investigators soon brought additional pieces of the puzzle in the complex picture of the failure, shifting the root cause of the problem from Cord to the engines themselves. As it turned out, 6 seconds after liftoff, high-frequency vibrations had torn off a gas pressure measuring pipe located downstream from the turbopump in engine number 2. To make matters worse, at T plus 25 seconds, a pipe for measuring fuel pressure before the gas generator had also broken off, spewing kerosene into the guts of the rocket, inevitably leaking gas with a temperature of 340 degrees had ignited the kerosene and started a massive fire in the tail section of the rocket 55 seconds after the liftoff. The flames had destroyed insulation on power supply cables, which were running alongside Cord's cables. As a result, a low-frequency signal of 1,000 Hz had leaked into the Cord sensors and had been interpreted as out-of-limit pulsations in gas generators inside the turbopumps of the propulsion system. At this time, a 25-volt signal, which exceeded allowable voltage by 10 volts, had traveled across the entire web of the Cord network. The Cord had responded by shutting down all 28 engines at 68.7 seconds after liftoff. Moreover, the faulty command had also traveled up to the second and third stages of the rocket, leaving the giant vehicle completely paralyzed. On March 7th, the investigative team presented their findings to the rest of the N1 engineering team. The root cause of the failure in the first N1 launch was thus declared to be resolved. Not surprisingly, the program officials pressed for another attempt as soon as possible. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 176 of the Space Rocket History Podcast, entitled The First Test Flight of the Soviet N1. Space Rocket History is a proud member of the History Podcasters and the Tech Podcasting Network. Sincere apologies for mispronouncing the Russian names, and I want to give a big shout out to all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed, and I want to extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. I'm awfully glad you're here. Today, we salute my MIR-level donors. MIR donors give $80 or more during the calendar year. Thanks for your continued support, MIR donors. I had a few thoughts on this episode. For new listeners, I'll just point out that these are my opinions, not necessarily facts. Just what I have observed and researched. First of all, what did you think of the N1? Now, that closed-loop rocket engine was years ahead of its time. The Soviets were definitely on the bleeding edge of technology with that design. But you have to admire them for trying. It took a lot of complex plumbing to feed fuel and oxidizer into the clustered arrangement of the rockets, and the plumbing proved to be pretty fragile on that first flight. Also, keep in mind that they had to transport everything by rail. All the stages of the N1 had to be broken down and reassembled once they got to the launch site. The engines for Block A could only be test-fired individually. But the entire cluster of 30 engines was never static-tested as a unit. I believe even that there were only 2 out of every 6 engines that were actually tested. So when the rocket was launched, the vibrations were so bad it ripped apart propellant lines and turbines, and these problems could not be discovered until it actually flew. So, that's an expensive way to find out. Now, what did you think about those calculations made by the Central Research Institute of Machine Building? They calculated that there was just a 1% chance the N1 would complete all its tasks, and a 16% chance that it would fulfill its mission. Well, you can't tell the big wigs that this is going to happen on your first launch, and you got like a 1% chance. They would have been mad. So what do you do? Well, you have to adjust the calculations and take out any failures caused by lack of quality control or by operations errors. So they massage the numbers to get a better chance of success. They got up to 67% with a margin of error between 38% to 90%. So they brought it to the meeting because they thought, well, they did a good job to get it up to 67%. But the commission meeting was shocked that it was at 67%. So what do they do? Well, Paul Eugen effectively said, forget about all these calculations. All we really need is personal assurances from all the top managers about flawless operations of their system. Now, do you think anybody there was going to say their system wouldn't work or their equipment wouldn't work and they've got the thing about ready to launch? You think they would say that? Not too likely. So, you just massage the numbers and move on and then blow up a rocket. I've posted some pictures and, of course, the audio for this mission on the website, spacerockethistory.com. Please check that out. In donations, we had four here, a couple of changes, and a couple of new donors. Sreko R. from Bosnia and Herzegovina donated at the Sputnik level. Thank you, Sreko. Justin M. increased his pledge on Patreon to the Apollo level. Neil C. also increased his pledge on Patreon to the Apollo level. Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Neil. Frederick N. pledged on Patreon at the Gemini level. Thank you, Frederick. So that brings up our total donors to 68 on Patreon. And the overall donors have reached 157 with a goal of reaching 250 by the end of 2016. So we are running behind on that goal. The dog days of summer are eating our lunch. So if you're enjoying the podcast, I certainly would appreciate your kind support. It doesn't have to be a lot. You can make a one-time Sputnik level donation for $5, or you can make a minimum donation of 50 cents per month at Patreon. Consider it sort of a voluntary subscription. To make a one-time donation, go to the homepage, spacerockethistory.com, and click on the orange donate button on the top right of the page. Or you can sign up with Patreon by clicking the Patreon link also on the homepage, just below the donate button. The URL for Patreon, if you want to go directly there, is patreon.com/spacerockethistory, all one word. All donors are rewarded with their name on the donors page on the website, spacerockethistory.com, based on their donation level. Donors that donate 2 years in a row receive the rocket emoji, and those who donate 3 years in a row receive the treasured moon emoji. To stay updated on the podcast, including previews of the next episode, please follow me on Twitter. My handle is @spacerockethist. If you would like to be notified when the next podcast is available, you can sign up for the email list on the homepage. To do that, you go to the homepage and scan down the right column of the page until you see Subscribe to Blog by Email. Put your email address in there and click Subscribe. I want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. Feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media. And thanks to those who have already done so, like my retweeters, Jet City Star, 1202 Alarm, Ashley James Lee, ATM Int Arch, Buddy P. Murphy, Beacon 63, Chris Towers, David Runta, David Nugent, Duke of Oil 60, Floppy Sasquatch, For Devil, Futurama King, Glenn Trudgett, Jacob Hahn, Kadavi 1202, KHS Astronomy, Peewee 888, Pompeiator, Rapid Mustang, Rapid Wolf 95, Skibby, Stephen Lebowski, Sticky, This is Alex Boyd, Tomasino 1202, and W.S. LaFoy. I really appreciate it. If I missed you, let me know and I'll get you next week. This is the end of the content for this episode. Had a few off-topic thoughts. If you're not interested, please feel free to switch to the next podcast. Thanks for sticking around, folks. Hope that episode was enjoyable. Next week, we will begin coverage of Apollo 9. Yay! I can't wait to get back to Apollo. I really love that program. I've got the schedule made up all the way to Apollo 11 now. So after we finish 9, we will go ahead and do Apollo 10. Then we'll take a little bit of a break and get into the second N1 flight. And then we'll do Luna 15, which was launched in July of 1969. And then we will finally reach what most of us have been waiting for, the Apollo 11. So, the moon landing is within sight. I hope we get there before we get the 4th anniversary of the show. We might make it. Okay, in podcast news, we had a fantastic number of downloads in August. I think it was the highest month ever. June was actually higher, but there was an anomaly that month because there was like just a ridiculous huge amount of downloads all of a sudden there. And I questioned the statistics there, and actually my podcast server company said that they had a problem. So I'm kind of not counting June. I think I'm going to count August as the highest one ever because we really had some great downloads this month. Now, the podcast was heard in 85 countries around the world, and here are the top 10 countries with the most episode downloads for August. U.S., U.K., Germany, Australia, Canada. That's the first five. That usually is the first five. Now, for number 6 is something different. Japan jumped up to 6th place. That was a huge jump for Japan. New Zealand moved up to 7th. Sweden now is in 8th place. And Denmark is in 9th place. And Ireland moved up to 10th place. So, we had a few changes in the second five there. The first five usually runs about that way. Sometimes the UK and Germany will swap places between 2 and 3, but not this month. In listener news, I received an email from Clayton V. He alerted me that there was a new documentary on Netflix about the N1. It is called Cosmodrome. I had seen parts of this documentary on YouTube clips, but now it's on Netflix if you have it. And I think it's not been on there very long. So check that out. And if you do, you will see several people that I have mentioned on the podcast there. You can be able to put a face with the podcast. So also on that thing, I found yet another pronunciation for Korolev. It seems like every documentary I see pronounces Korolev's name differently. So I can say, with some certainty, that my pronunciation is probably not correct. I'm pretty confident that I am not doing the correct pronunciation, but I'm not sure who is. That's the problem. But you know who I'm talking about. Korolev is the chief designer of OKB-1, or was the chief designer. In personal news, I had hoped to leave on another camping trip this week, but I had a health scare that I had to get checked out pretty quickly. I won't bore you with all the details. I'll just say, thank God I'm okay. It was looking pretty serious on Sunday afternoon. You go through things like this and you realize how fragile life can be, and it can be over in an instant. So it makes you appreciate things a little more. I still have a few more doctor visits that I need to get done before we leave on the trip, so I'm going to put it off a little bit. But I hope to go before it gets too cold. And I also want to mention I got some more good news about my grandson, Evan. Remember, he was born 2 months early, and he was having some trouble with his hemoglobin. His body wasn't replenishing it. So he got tested again on Tuesday, and we were so delighted to find out that his hemoglobin was up, and his body is doing what it's supposed to. So he's finally getting over that preemie type thing and into just a regular baby. And he looks good, and he acts normal to me, so he's a great little boy. And since he is my grandson, you know, I'm very happy that he is healthy too. So that's really good news. Two good news in this podcast. Okay, I think that's all the time I have for this week. I hope to get episode 177 up by next Thursday. It's Apollo 9, and I cannot wait. I want to do Apollo 9, really. All right, stand by for Apollo 9 one more week. So long for now.